Sergeant Button, but you said you gave us A, so our only choice is really C, am I correct? Over.
Just for the sake of a simple story, you chose A. It could be that you chose B and I showed you A and it had a penny. So you can have it any way that you want. I just kind of moved it along a little bit faster. But it was your choice of one out of the three envelopes. I just happened to choose for you, but you could choose for yourself.
Understood, thank you.
Yes, Eric.
All right. When you're first presented with the three to choose, each one is, you've got a 33 1/3% chance of picking the right one. Now, we've now shown you one and taken that away, so you've wound up with a number that's 2/3, or 66 2/3% chance. If you go and choose the other one, than the original setup, you've now changed the odds from 1/3 to something more.
Care to suggest what the odds would be?
Oh, I'm not going to embarrass myself. I'm not sure I should be able to think that through in my head.
Okay, we're circling around the right answer. Is there anyone else who wants to give their opinion? Interesting how probability questions can be thought-provoking.
E2FRU, like I said earlier, you went from 1 in 3 to 1 in 2, and you had a gut feeling in one choice. Do you stay with your gut feeling in the second choice? Door number one, door number two, door number three, or door number one or door number two.
Well, yes, George, that's the situation, and that's your solution to it, which is fine. I'm just wondering if anyone else has any other opinions, because we heard a whole bunch of them, and they're all interesting to me, and I just want to make sure that we exhausted this. Hey, Dick, I guess it's your turn.
I've read various answers to this one. I've got a slightly different way of explaining it. When you, Roy, chose envelope A, and there were three envelopes, right then it was undisturbed. You had exactly a 1/3 chance of choosing the envelope with the $1 million check. In the case of Monty Hall's program, he was omniscient. He had hidden knowledge. He knows he's going to show you another door, or in this case, another envelope. He knows he's not going to show you the one with the $1 million check. That's a given. He's going to show you the one that doesn't have $1 million checks. So the fact that he's now giving you additional information and he has hidden knowledge changes the odds. Therefore, after he's shown you, let's say, door B, envelope B, with the one penny check, he has now revealed to you some additional information. Now you have choices of sticking with A or going to C. Because he has given you additional information, the odds, if you didn't move, you started off with a 3-to-1 chance. If you didn't move, you still have a 1/3 chance of your original choice being right. Because he has given you additional information by showing you one that is not correct, the two choices now go to 2-to-1, 50% chance, if and only if you switch and go over to C. When you go over to C, you now have a 50% chance of being right. If you stick with A, you made no change of your original chance, which was a 1/3 chance. So by switching, you go from 1/3 chance to a 1/2 chance.
Repeater, timeout.
So various ways of explaining it will tell you you should switch. And if they really did take statistical information on the show, and if they did it objectively with a whole lot of people, I believe they would have found out 50% chance of right for the person who switches and one-third chance of being right for people who did not switch. I believe that should be the answer, and maybe it got remembered wrong in various people's minds watching that show. That's one way of looking at it. AC2GS, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, I would have one little problem with that, because if the chance of envelope A having the $1 million is 33%, and if the possibility of the other choice is 50%, then the probability of one of those two should be the same, which would be 83%.
Don't agree. You can't add these. If you stick with A, you didn't change anything. You started off with one-third, and you're still one-third chance of being right. When you jump over to C, when you switch, you now jump to a 50% chance of being right. The possibility exists that A was right. The possibility exists that C is right. But since there's only two that are left, you jump to 50% probability if you switch. You stay at one-third probability if you didn't switch. So your choices are E being one-third of the chance being right or 50% chance being right if you switch. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Okay, anyone else have any opinions about that or any aspect of this little problem before I wrap it up in a bow?
So you're saying probability does not change with additional information?
Didn't say that. The probability does change with the additional information if you use the additional information. To use the additional information, you have to switch. Of course, at first, that's opposite of common sense. K2LAW.
N2HVR.
Yes, Nick.
Okay, after listening to everybody, I'm still with my gut choice as the A, but only because by you showing me what was not in envelope C was not the one, made no difference to the odds. They're still the same. In other words, by you showing me that this one had nothing in it or a penny in it, means nothing to the other two, because it's not like the other two envelopes depend on the information. It's like flipping a penny. I can keep flipping a penny and getting heads, and then you would say, well, logically, the next one should be a tail, but the penny doesn't know that it's flipping heads, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, the complicating factor is that Monty Hall has infinite knowledge. He is not going to reveal the $1 million check. That hidden knowledge, you can only use it if you flip. I know that sounds crazy. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, I mean, once again, anyone with any further comments? Because this seems to be fascinating, everyone including me.
Oh, N2HVR, Roy, did you know before you opened envelope C, did you already know what envelope the $1 million was in?
Yes. This is basically called the Monty Hall problem, or the Monty Hall paradox. The MC knows what everything is because he put it in the envelope. So he, as Dick mentioned, has godlike knowledge, and you, the player, don't.
I stick with my same answer. I stick with the original choice, A.
Okay, very good. George, you wanted to ask Vanna White for a vowel?
B2FIU, standing by.
Okay. It's not unfortunate. The probability of any one of the three envelopes that are sealed in front of you has the $1 million is 33 1/3%. That's the probability. Now, when you choose A, and again, you could mix up any of these things. The guy, I know where the $1 million is, and I'm opening up B when you pick A. There's still probability is 3 1/3% for each of the envelopes. So if you stay with your choice of A, you continue to have a 33 1/3% chance of picking the $1 million. But since I already identified B is not the choice, you're effectively able to choose B and C. B and C have a percentage of 66 2/3. So you get twice the odds by switching. And that's the paradox or problem that's Monty Hall. And you can go on computer on websites, and there are little programs that can have you run through this algorithm, and it'll demonstrate that your probabilities are 1/3 for staying pat and 2/3 for choosing the other door or envelope. So that's the answer. A lot of people had it right to switch, but the odds, surprisingly, are not 50%, but 66%.
But wouldn't that odd be the same of choosing it wrong 66%?
Say again, I couldn't quite make out every word. Now it was all noise.
GX, I want to comment.
Sure, comment away.
I would say both the gentleman and I who watched the MythBusters show remember it the wrong way. If you choose door number A and none of the other two doors are revealed to you, the odds are better of you staying with A than picking another door, WB2GXM.
Don't see how. If no one chooses any of the doors, then you started with a probability of 1 out of 3 and you finished with 1 out of 3 because nothing really changes. So I don't see how, unless I'm misunderstanding what you're saying. I mean, it sounds like I'm giving you the 3 envelopes, you're picking A. I'm not telling you that B is 1 penny. I'm just saying, are you sure you want A? Would you like to try B or C? Under those circumstances, there's no advantage of staying pat. You're trading 1/3 of a probability for another 1/3 of a probability.
Question is, if you decide to switch, you have a 66.5% of switching wrong, because the two that are left, either one would be 66.5%.
Well, no. If you want to figure the probability of picking wrong, then you have to. It changes the entire equation. You have a 1/3 chance of guessing right. You have a 2/3 chance of guessing wrong for each of them. If you want to do your probabilities like that for some strange reason, but it's the probability of choosing correctly is 1/3 for one of them, but is 2/3. For two of them. So that's where the 66 2/3 comes from.
Yeah, let me challenge that a little bit, Groy. We know that Monty Hall has infinite knowledge. We know he's not going to display the $1 million check. That's a given. So therefore, when he opened up B and he knew it was a 1 penny check, you've confirmed it's a 1 penny check. Now you get the choice of staying with A or going to C. The usual definition, let me drop. The usual definition of probability is number of cases favorable divided by the number of choices favorable divided by the total number of choices. After Monty has opened up envelope B for you, B is gone, you're certainly not going to choose it. You can either stay with A or go to C. We know that only one of those, A or C, has the check. So you've only got one favorable case. Total number of cases are 2. That would suggest that the probability if you switch, goes to 50%. I'm having trouble finding out how you can get two-thirds probability when probability is total number of cases favorable divided by total number of cases. 1 divided by 2 seems to be 50%. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Okay, let's try this little modification of the premise. You have the envelopes A, B, and C. You choose A. What if I have the option of changing from A to both B and C? What would the probabilities be?
I see your point. Let me think about that. Go right ahead.
Okay, very good, because in that decision, the discovery of the state of one of the three doesn't change the initial probabilities. So when you choose to swap, you've effectively chosen the outcome as though you had picked two different envelopes. One of the envelopes is always going to be one penny, no matter what you do, because there's only $1 million check of the three of them. So ultimately, it's the same probabilistic situation, just presented a little bit differently. So it's a little bit more obviously.
So if I understand you correctly, you're quite convinced the probability goes to being two-thirds in your favor if you switch and choose envelope C.
Yes, that's what I'm saying, and that's what the if you look up the Monty Hall problem, and matter of fact, I have a website for you, monty.ac2gs.com, and it will do a nice little I think it's a YouTube. There's loads of YouTubes. You just have to YouTube Monty Hall problem, and you'll find a slew of them. It's a very interesting. And very useful. You know, I kind of wish I could go in a time machine and go back to the Monty Hall, let's make a deal, and try it out.
As I mentioned to you in the email sent to you today, Roy, many of your websites work like a charm. That particular one, Monty, when I went there, my computer said there was nothing there. Error number 404. Over to you.
FIU, George.
And some of the aliases sometimes don't make it, especially YouTube is very weird. Sometimes the YouTube links are able to be aliased and sometimes they're not. So I'll double check it. But all, like I said before, all you have to do is go to YouTube, type in Monty Hall problem, and pick one of the videos that have been seen by 500,000 people, because a lot of people have seen it. And they're all reasonably good. You know, don't go see a YouTube that 10 people have seen, because, you know, if you do that, you see all kinds of strange things. There's a YouTube where there's a young woman who's worried that we're using up all of our space.
To FIU, George.
George.
With Let's Make a Deal, he was also using the same design of rotational stage that General Electric was using in their 1964 World's Fair exhibition in New York City. So he was able to rotate the stages for the right and wrong design and answers to come up for the people when the doors opened up.
Thank you, George, for adding that technical note. I wasn't aware of the technology involved in Let's Make a Deal. I know historically when it started out, people dressed normally for about a week or two. Then someone figured out that if you dress like a complete lunatic, you might get called and win a prize. And so everyone started to dress like complete lunatics.
I won't even tell you how I'm dressed right now.
That's probably for the best, George. So, anyone else have any comments, questions, disbelief, belief in the Monty Hall problem?
That was funny. What George just said, does that mean after Monty showed you door number two, and then you decided to either stay with door number one, because that was your choice, or go over to door number three, that after you told him what you're going to do, he could make a further choice, he could make a further change behind the scenes before your chosen door was open? Is that what George was saying? Over to you, Roy.
I hope not. I kind of trusted Monty. Is that what you're kind of describing, George, that he kind of faked people out?
All I remember reading was is that the actual rotation was available. Whether he did it or not, I don't know. But I remember learning from people who worked in those studios, they did it in order to prepare themselves for the next staging. KD2FIU.
That means Monty had control of the number of people who won just to keep it interesting. He had that control whether or not he used it. Wow.
Well, I guess it's a good thing he's passed on, so we're not going to arrest poor Monty.
Let me ask you then that he actually controlled almost who was.
Somebody else in there on a double.
That was a triple. Let's see if Roy can sort that all out. Roy, you were part of a triple.
Okay, let me try this again. Dick, how did you spell Monty for monty.ac2gs.com?
I didn't spell it. I swiped it from your email.
Okay, I got to go into my email. Maybe I typoed, because if you actually do type monty.ac2gs.com, I got the YouTube video, so maybe I mistyped it when I wrote the letter to you.
And by the way, you would have to have made a double mistake. Maybe in your first email to me yesterday, there were three things that I could have chosen. The first one worked like a charm. The other two both gave me an error, and I said that to you in my second email to you.
Okay, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. It's curious. And I'm looking at the mail, and I typed it monty.ac2gs.com. So for some odd reason, YouTube is letting me see the video but not letting you see the video. So maybe it's something real wonky with YouTube. So ultimately, with any of these things, if you guys can't quite get to the YouTube, just list the search parameter of Monty Hall, and you'll see some fine videos. It's a very nice demonstration. Okay, on to the next little question. Now, Paul often talks about the ISS, that we've grown to know and love it so very well. And I'm wondering if some people have a slightly skewed view of how things are on the space station. So I'd first like to ask people, if you look out the window of the space station, what percentage of the Earth do you think you can see out of a window? You stick your face right up against the window, you look out in the general direction of the Earth. What percentage of the Earth can you see?
2GPF. I think it would be determined by the distance and squared with the window diameter.
Okay, I'll give you the distance. The ISS is approximately 254 miles above the surface of the Earth. And just for the sake of arbitrary what-the-heck-ism, the window is infinitely large. So there's no cutoff because the window's too small.
And they do have one window that gives you the equivalent of a dome, a full hemisphere of view from the space shuttle. So you're not limited by the window on the International Space Station. So you're only limited by the 254 miles. Over to you, Roy.
And in fact, there are videos of, you know, astronauts floating through the ISS, looking out the window. But I'm wondering if people paid attention when they saw it. So once again, I'm asking people out there, give me a percentage that they think you can see of the planet Earth from the ISS station.
Yep, I would say 50%, because you could probably get to see one side of the Earth.
He's giving a very popular answer. And when you guys hear the answer, you'll find it surprising. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, indeed, and we'll even go into explaining how far you have to be to see 50% of the Earth. So does anyone else have any other percentages in mind?
Sorry, Roy, I didn't hear the whole question, but I know from experience, I worked Oscar 13 back in the late 80s, and to see half the planet, a geosynchronous orbit is at 22,000 miles above the Earth's planet. Then you can see half the planet. Back to you.
Good guess, but that's only close. Go ahead, Roy.
We'll get into the 50% number, but I'm still, and we're still back at the ISS that I'm giving you is 254 miles above us. So I'd just like someone to offer some percentage. I mean, is it 45? Is it 1%? You know, give me a rough estimate. I'll give you a range of 10 degrees. How's that?
If you look out window A, you can see one-third. If you look out B or C, you can see two-thirds.
Doing a joke on the Monty Hall problem.
Why don't we simplify it by saying that there's a hemispherical dome on the bottom of the ISS aimed toward the Earth, and your head is in the middle of that dome. There's only one window where there is no window limitation on the ISS. Let's use that simplification as my suggestion, Roy. Go ahead.
WS-20.
We'll recognize one question, one little statement. I'd even make it easier by saying the person's in a spacesuit outside of the ISS, and they're just looking down the Earth. So how's about that for a description?
There's one window in Discovery that you could look out. One window in the Discovery, Destiny module. And they always have a camera looking down. Maybe you should just use that one. If you use the cupola, that's the one with the multiple windows, six trapezoid windows. That's gonna throw everybody off. You gotta look out one porthole like they have in the Destiny.
Paul, I'm just trying to really simplify this. It's a thought experiment, so I don't want people to be too concerned about the limitations of the window. So once again, you're in a spacesuit and you're looking out. So the visor is open all over the place. You don't have any limitation based on the visor. It's just you and the Earth out there, and what percentage of the surface of the Earth can you see from the ISS elevation? That's the question. EDH. EDH.
I'd say about 10% at a height of 254 miles. Go ahead.
Okay, that's a good approximation. Anyone else with any degrees, percentages, what have you?
Okay, KDTTBF, I guess if you were sitting there and it was whatever azimuth you were facing towards the Earth, you would only see a certain percent of 50% of the moon. I would believe.
Hey, I think you're answering the wrong question, though. The question is, what percentage of the Earth are you seeing, not the moon?
I'll flip that. I'll say how much of the sunlight would be on the moon.
You know what? I'm really thinking about this question. Let me think a few minutes. Sorry.
Hey, you think about it a little bit more, and I would like to get some opinions from other people out there. If anyone has, so far we have 50% and we have 10%. Anyone with any other numbers in their heads? Gosh, no one? I mean, can you sort of see the video in your mind's eye even though I said don't do the window pane as a limitation, but still, I mean, just anyone have any kind of idea of what percentage we might be thinking of?
33 1/3.
Okay, we're back to Monty Hall.
WS20.
Paul.
Well, we know it can't be more than 50%, because if you're all the way out at the L1 position looking back, then that camera definitely sees 50%, but you can't go more than that.
It also depends on the distance from the Earth you are.
That's why I'm telling everyone it's 254 miles above the surface of the Earth. And actually, I don't want to get nitpicky about the whole thing, but you can only see 50% of the entire Earth when you get to infinity. It's one of those asymptotic relationships where you see 49.9999999% of the Earth. But in order to actually reach 50%, you would have to be infinitely far away from it. It's just one of those weird ways that geometry works.
N2HVR with Comet.
Yes, Nick.
Okay, so that's it. I don't know the percentage. I know it's less than 50. But the geometry is that if you know from the, let's say you're looking at the Earth on a flat map from one end to the other, A and B, and the space station is C, and you know the distance between the surface and it's like an isosceles triangle, you know the distance between A and B, and you get the angle of C, you could actually figure out the footprint. I don't know it off the top of my head, but there is definitely a distinct footprint at that altitude. I would say it would be, at this point, maybe 25%, maybe.
Okay, Nick, I agree with you that it's calculatable, that it's just geometry in action once again. So we will write down your percentage. Does anyone else have any sense of what percentage of the Earth can be seen by the eye, I said?
And YDY with a guess?
Sure, Hank. Guess away.
Well, from that altitude, you should be able to see about 1,450 miles or so, a little less, in any one direction. So if you're seeing 3,000 miles or so, 2,800 miles or so, from one end to the other, and then the Earth is, what, 3,600 miles in circumference at the equator, you're seeing, what, 3,000 out of 3,600 miles, so it's less than 50, obviously, since we've discussed that already, but tremendously more than 33 1/3, so my guess would be somewhere around 45%.
Okay, anyone else with any possible solutions to this?
I've actually done a calculation. Maybe I'm a little bit unfair. I have a guess. You tell me when I should give it.
It's like saving you for last, Dick, because you either give me the answer or you come so close to the answer that it's anyway. I just want to get everyone else's opinions, and then we'll go to you. So is there anyone else out there who has any gut feelings or any calculations off the back of an envelope I love to use backs of envelopes for calculations, about the percentage of visible surface of the Earth from the ISS.
By the way, Hank just gave us a good piece of information. When you're doing a conversation with the ISS, from 1,400 miles, you have line of sight to them. So from the ISS, they can see 1,400 miles. That gives you a very strong hint, and you'd be amazed how the mathematics of that works out. Back to you, Roy.
Okay. Anyone else with any opinions, thoughts, gut feelings, what have you?
82FIU?
Yes, George.
Just a factor here. Doesn't the convex elliptical view of the Earth from out there have anything to do with the equation?
Oh, yeah. You have to figure that you're looking at an oblong circular sphere. But again, it's not that difficult to do geometry based on that.
Thank you.
I think one of the things that people should keep in mind is how incredibly close the ISS really is to the surface of the Earth. You know, when push comes to shove, 245 miles in the scheme of things is not that far away. So the problem is that when people draw pretty pictures, they distort the scale to emphasize things that kind of ruin the correct interpretation of how close some things are to each other. So that's my little hint for today.
WS2N.
Maybe 20% if you're lucky.
Okay, someone suggested 20% if you're lucky, and I don't know if you're not lucky. I wonder if it goes up or down. Paul, you have a comment.
In one of Carl Sagan's books, he describes it as the wax on a bowling ball. You know, a little thicker than that. That's roughly low Earth orbit for the space station.
Yes, I agree. I mean, and that's the sort of trick to this question, because I think in everyone's mind eye, they see this big gap between the surface of the Earth and the ISS and the Moon, and everything is sort of around the same distance away, because that's the way people like to draw it, because if you draw it too close together, you don't know what you're looking at because it's too close, and if you draw it too far, like the Sun, then it goes off the page onto the next page and the next page, and you never see the two items together. So the scale is always wrong with most of these illustrations. So I would agree with Carl Sagan's comment about the wax on a bowling ball.
Earth has a radius of 3,956 miles. The ISS is 254 miles above the surface of the Earth. It's only 6% further in radius than the radius of the whole Earth. That's another hint. Over to you, Roy.
Okay. Once again, anyone have any opinions, gut feelings, or equations and would like to share it with the group? Okay, I guess it's your turn, Dick.
If you use the Earth having a radius of 3956 and the surface of a sphere is 4 pi r squared, 4 pi r squared is the surface. Therefore, the Earth has a surface of a little bit shy of 197 million square miles. That's the total surface of the Earth. A little shy, 196.66. Let's call it 197 million square miles. Because of the altitude and the Earth curvature, you could be 1,400 miles away from the ISS and see it. Very similar to when I talked to an astronaut on Space Shuttle number 6. Let me drop it. was over northern Texas. I was on Long Island, 1,400 miles away. He was just barely over my horizon. Radio line of sight I had to him. So from the altitude of either a space shuttle or the ISS, a little bit different, you see roughly 1,400 miles. A circle on the Earth with a radius of 1,400 square miles is around 6 million square miles total, six and a fraction. So he is looking at 6 million square miles. When he looks at all possible directions from the perfect window on the ISS, but the Earth has 197 million square miles. Answer is 3%. From the ISS, with perfect vision, no blockage at the ISS, your vision can see everything there is except for what Earth curvature is giving you. You can only see 3% of the Earth at any one period of time while you're in that orbit. That's kind of amazing, and that's why you chose this one, I think, Roy. AC2GS, K2LAW.
Right you are with the answer, and right you are with the reason why I posed the question. Because I think most people don't bother to see the background of the ISS, where there's this little teeny piece of Earth coming out of the window, and they just kind of recall images they see from NASA of Earthscapes from beyond the orbit of the moon, and they just kind of put two and two together and they fuse the memories. So I thought that unless someone did a Wikipedia search or did a calculation at the back of the envelope, 3%, no one would, less than 3% of people would get 3%. But that's what it amounts to. 3% of the surface of the Earth is the most that can be visible from the ISS, which strikes me as sort of amazing, personally.
A comment?
That is amazing. We would never have thought that. Sorry, KD2BPF. Sorry.
No reason to be sorry. VDH, you wanted to make a comment?
Well, I was always thinking that it was way out in the space. You're looking out the window. But when you really think about it, it's almost like a low Earth orbit. I've been trying to get in satellites lately. And if you're actually looking out the window and see it, it's probably right. I never thought about. I guess you really had to listen to the question the whole time and come up with the answer, but it's very, very informative, over.
Very good. Dick, isn't there a relationship for the distance to the horizon given the altitude? Could you use that relationship?
Or anyone with just...
Yes, you could.
The density of water at 3 degrees centigrade. I mean, no one can really do much with that. But I have yet another question, if everyone is finished with the ISS and looking down at the Earth.
Somebody just asked the question, is there a formula? If you know your altitude above the Earth, and if you assume the Earth is a smooth billiard ball, you're not worried about mountains and oceans and whatever, I think the formula is twice the altitude in miles, square root, is the number of miles you can see. And by the way, a human being, you can do an experiment, let me drop it.
If you will, in one whitey white.
You can do an experiment where you're lying with your head right on the sands of the seashore as the sun sets, and the sun just sets over the horizon. Assume it's a low ocean state day. At the instant the Earth sets, you stand up straight and you're 6 feet and tall, and now for how much longer can you see the sun setting? And I think the answer is another 30 seconds or something like that. You see something like 3 miles because of Earth curvature. So, let me think. Hank is about to correct me, but I vaguely remember the formula is that twice the number of miles square root is the number of miles that you can see because of Earth curvature. Correct me on that one, Hank. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know how accurate it is, but the number that I was taught when I was learning to fly was 1.229. So, call it 123 times the square root of the altitude difference between the height of the transmitter and the height of the receiver. So essentially for the spaceship or space station, the altitude of the space station over the Earth, 1.23 times the square root of the altitude.
And with that, you'll come up with something close to 1,400 miles. So the area that he can see is 4 pi, is pi r squared. But the total area of the surface of the sphere is 4 pi r squared, where r is 3956, radius of Earth. So radius of Earth, 3956, versus 1,400 miles square radius of a circle on the surface of the Earth. That turns out to be 3%. It's a real amazing one, Roy. Go ahead.
82FIU.
George.
Dick, if I understood this correctly, you're saying at 6 feet, as you're watching the sunset, when does it drop below the horizon? Was that correct?
Yes, and I forget the exact number. It's something like 30 seconds or 1 minute. So the sun has set while your face is on the sand. The sun has set over the horizon. At the instant it sets, you stand up immediately and watch it set again. How long will that take, or how far can you see, so to speak, when you're 6 feet off the surface of the sun, off the surface of the water? I think you can see something like 3 miles, but the sun is moving, because of Earth's rotation, the sun appears to be moving 15 degrees per hour. And so we can work out the mathematics of that, but something like 30 seconds or 1 minute is the additional time it takes to set again when you stand up and watch it set the second time. I'll double-check the mathematics on that, but it's in that order. Back to you, George.
Somehow I remember 13.3, 13.5 miles. I don't know the time, but this is something I learned very young. I thought it was 13.3 miles at 6 feet high.
A comment?
You're probably right on that one, but there's one other thing to remember here. The sun is a half a degree wide. Earth is rotating 15 degrees per hour. Half a degree versus 15 is a 30-to-1 ratio. So if you see the, assuming if there was no dispersion of the sunlight going through the air at a slanting angle, assume you didn't have that phenomenon. From the time the bottom of the sun sets versus the top of the sun, top of the sun setting, should be a 30-to-1 ratio. I think the answer is 2 minutes. Yeah, I think it's 15 degrees per hour, half a degree. I'll work out the mathematics again. KQIW listening.
Comment.
Comment away.
Now, if we're talking that you're laying down and then you stand up to see the azimuth deviation or whatever, wouldn't it be a 45-degree inclination integrated into that?
I don't think so. When your face is on the sand, your eyesight is now tangential to a smooth water right near you. When you stand up 6 feet higher, then the line of sight to the water is some small number of miles away from you. In both cases, the difference in the angle between your eye and that water, first when you're on the surface, when your face is on the sand versus being up, I don't think you've moved half a degree of change in declination angle just because you've raised 6 feet, because Earth is awfully big. 3956 miles in radius. So there's Earth curvature there, but by your and my standards, it's a very slow curvature. KQLAW.
KQPDF. Just to add something to this, the other day, me and my wife were walking around our block, and I had to stop and go pee. And I looked up, and I saw this thing flying so close. It was a disc. It was a UFO. It was amazing. I tried to look up on all my different apps that I have for satellites because I would like to communicate with them, but it was definitely a UFO. I never saw anything like that besides when I was in the Hudson Valley back in the 80s when I was in high school and saw one. It was amazing, amazing.
Matt, describe the shape of the object and what time of day did you see it?
Oh, it was about 11:30, p.m. It flew very fast. By the time I could basically look from one side of the Earth to the other, it was very low and not really fast, but very fast. And I thought it was a satellite, but I said, there's so much cloud.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So was the object a round, white object that you saw go from horizon to horizon? And how long did that take, like 30 seconds?
Correct. It was a round object, and it took about maybe 20 seconds to go from one side of the horizon to the other. It was heading from west to east.
You'll be unhappy to know that my son has and I have both seen a number of those. But that's another whole subject. We shouldn't get off of Roy's subject for right now. Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, Dick, did you have anything you wanted to say about the situation of seeing 50% of any planet?
Yes, I did. You can only see a hemisphere of a round spherical object if your line of sight hits the upper edge and your line of sight hits the lower edge, and those two line of sights are perfectly parallel. That can only happen at an infinite distance. So when you're at a really high distance, like geosynchronous altitude, 22,300 miles, I don't know what the number is, but it's got to be less than 50%. It may be 40% of the Earth you can see. From the moon, which is a very long distance, 240,000 miles, my guess is you see 48% of the Earth, so to speak. To really see 50% of the Earth, you'd have to be at an infinite distance. Not easy to do. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
How about the Discover mission at 1 million miles, Dick?
All right. See, is 1 million miles compared to something that's let me think that, 3956, a little shy of 8,000 miles in diameter of the Earth, 8,000 miles in diameter, and you're a million miles away. We can work out the geometry of that, and it may work out to be 48 or 49% of the Earth can be seen from that distance. You'd have to be at an infinite distance to see it all, and when you're at an infinite distance, you better be using the darn good telescope, because now it's going to look awful small. Over to you on that one, Paul, and then pass it over to Roy.
Yeah, okay. Discover sends back pictures every day, and they look back, and they're looking at that whole hemisphere. So, but I mean, it looks like 50% to me, but every day they send back pictures. And that's at L1, so that's four times the distance of the moon. And back to you, Dick. I forget who you wanted to send it to.
Yeah, I'll do the mathematics for a million miles. I'm guessing it's going to work out 48% or something like that. Go ahead, Roy.
Please report.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's an asymptotic relationship, and if anyone has any problems with asymptotic curves, just Google tangent and see what a tangent line looks like. It goes on for infinity and never quite approaches. So although theoretically you could make a very nice picture that's 49% and almost no one will quibble with you, scientists and obsessive compulsive people will, because 49 isn't 50. You go farther, you can get 49.9. You go even farther, 49.99. You will never get to 50 because you would have to go to the end of the universe and beyond. Well, that was fun. I have other questions, but it's already after 11, and I'm sure that Paul wants to do his space report. So next week, unless something exciting happens over the next week, we can come back to the ISS and I can ask you some other questions that seem obvious that aren't quite so obvious. So I guess it's your turn, Paul.
Okay, I was waiting to see if Dick had one other comment. If not, I'll take it.
Yeah, from a million miles, you see 179.5 degrees swept angle versus 180. I think that's 99%. From a million miles, it might be 99%, Paul. But let's have the space report number 298. You got it, Paul.
Yeah, QSL. That's the right number. In the beginning of the night, you were talking about the launch of InSight, and I did send an email to you, to Roy and to you about the launch. I was hoping it was going to go up on time, so I did get up, make sure to watch that on Saturday morning, 7:05, so yesterday morning. And it went, it did go up. It was a very foggy day. So the people that were there locally in Vandenberg, California, couldn't really see it. They watched it on the screens like we did. But if you were further down to the south in L.A., you know, you had a chance of looking at it. But for them, it was 4:05 in the morning. For us, it was 7:05. But it was good to see it get off the launch pad. It launched on a 401 Atlas V rocket. 401 means it had a 4-meter diameter fairing up on top, and the zero stands for no solid boosters attached to it, and the one meant it had one engine on the second stage for the Centaur rocket. The first time they ever launched a planetary mission from California. Usually it goes from the East Coast, from either Florida, or we launched a lunar mission one time from Wallops Island, Virginia. But this was the first time from California, and the reason for that was, according to the manifest in Florida, there's many, many flights, and they knew this a couple of years ago when they had planned on launching from California. And in fact, this was supposed to launch 2 years ago, but with a couple of months left before the launch, they discovered they had a problem with the seismometer. That's located on the InSight spacecraft. The group that was building it was coming out of France. It's a multi-country effort, mostly NASA, but France was helping us out with the seismometer, and they had a vacuum problem, and they couldn't keep a tight seal. Turned it over to JPL. And they had it done in a couple of months, but by that time they lost the window. The launch window to Mars is roughly every 2 years, around 26 months. So sure enough, here we are, May 2018, they finally got it off the ground. And from what I saw recently, everything is going good. They had a good separation of the booster. Booster winds up in the Pacific Ocean. The second stage, the liquid oxygen Centaur upper stage, very reliable. They've launched like 400 or 500 of these Centaur rockets, so very reliable rocket. Pushed the spacecraft further along, and then separated from the payload, which was the InSight mission. That spacecraft separated, and by the way, the solar wings were open. They didn't have to open the solar wing inside this fairing. It was one less thing to worry about. So it separated, and it got off fine on the way to Mars. And, you know, it has a cruise stage, and then the landing InSight mission was attached to one piece, and now it's got 6 months to get to Mars. But in the back of this Centaur rocket, this RL-10C engine, right where the engine is, they have a one little compartment holding two satellites, and they were the MARCO satellites. MARCO stands for Mars CubeSat 1 satellite, even though there's two satellites. It was A and B in the back of this big second stage booster. When this thing goes into orbit, on the way to Mars, the second stage is still traveling with it. So they utilized that. They launched these two satellites from the back of the second stage, Marco 1 and Marco 2 separated. With that, they opened up their own solar panels, and their own, you know, it's got a X-band reflector antenna that opened up, and eventually the UHF opened up as well on the bottom. So the idea of Marco, these two Marco satellites, it's their own form of communication for the InSight mission.